The following is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Hi, welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM, broadcasting not live, but still from Montreal. My name is Pilar Steers.
And I'm Sophie Ho.
Today we broadcast from the Geogeage, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe nations. The time now is 5 p.m.
Today we've got some headlines discussing our recent climate change protests in Montreal, COVID updates in Quebec and Ontario, Royal Victoria Hospital in the Milton Park community, as well as the recent Indigenous MPs elected.
Following that, we have our main segment, an audio essay discussing the history of Indigenous peoples and voting in Canada, segueing into the lack of accessibility of polling stations for Indigenous voters in the 2021 Canadian federal election.
We'll be back with headlines after a short music break.
There's nothing to say. till the shark is released and sent and lies to the shifted.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. You're listening to CKUT on 90.3 FM. That was Your Ex-Lover is Dead by Stars, followed by Harriet by Hey Rosetta. Now it's time for our weekly headline roundup. On Friday, September 24th, 2 years after 500,000 Montrealers took to the streets in a massive climate strike led by young activist Greta Thunberg, thousands of students gathered to march for the fight against climate once again. Looking back on the historic march, the crowd consisted of all age groups walking from Mont-Royal to Peel Bazin. Among the group was Canada's now Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. The climate strike in 2019 was one of many massive rallies held in the world that week. The social and political impact that the strike had marked a shift in Canada. The goal of the climate strike was to signal that environmentalism was now a mainstream issue and priority for everyone. It was a chance to tell politicians that their statements and hypocrisy were not good enough, and to tell people who denied climate change as an issue how out of step they were with the majority of the population. In a crowd smaller than the one 2 years ago, likely due to the pandemic, as thousands march again, it begs the question, has the message from 2 years ago come through, and has there actually been significant change? Since then, there have been two federal elections in which minority Liberal governments have been sent to Ottawa, with the balance of power held by parties that back drastic action to fight the climate crisis. In the most recent campaign, the Conservatives, who fought strongly against endorsing a carbon tax to reduce emissions, were even forced to adopt a more credible environment stance just to stay relevant in the campaign. This shows a major shift in ideology over a short period of time. As winner of the most recent campaign, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau furthered his plans of action to reduce the effects of climate change. Montreal has also laid out Mayor Valérie Plante's plan to reduce emissions by 55% by 2030, a pledge she made to the United Nations 2 years ago Friday. Climate strikes, like the one led by Greta Thunberg 2 years ago, have ignited a wave of passion for the environment in many and has led to change among the world. Although scientific evidence suggests the Earth may hit the limit of warming set out by the Paris Accord within a decade, there's still time to avert from the worst-case scenario with stronger, definitive action. Although the steps that the Canadian government has taken in regards to the climate crisis are small, they are significant improvements. Governments around the world must now apply the lessons they learned during the COVID-19 pandemic to the climate crisis.
Three new Indigenous MPs were likely elected in the most recent federal election that had a record number of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit candidates. Conservative Adam Chambers, who is Métis, took the Simcoe North seat in Ontario. Lori Idlout, a member of the NDP, took the seat in Nunavut, prioritizing housing and mental health services for the territory. Edmonton Grishbach flipped from blue to orange, with Blake Desjarlais winning 39.9% of the vote. Mr. Desjarlais is also Métis and is the first Two-Spirit MP in the country. Global News reports that, quote, 9 of at least 78 candidates were incumbents and all successfully retained their seats, so if Desjarlais hangs on, there will be 12 Indigenous MPs in the 338-seat parliament, up one from the 2019 election, unquote. Dan Vandal was one of the Liberal incumbents to hold onto his seat and discussed some of the barriers that deter Indigenous candidates from running, such as the amount of financial backing one would need to run a campaign. Although new Indigenous candidates were brought into Parliament from this election, there is still a large gap in the number of candidates running and the number elected. Philip Charbonneau of Western University told Global News that, quote, I worry if there is continuing to be no better results, that enthusiasm will fizzle out, unquote. This being said, the three new Indigenous faces coming to Ottawa will aid in centering more conversations around Indigenous issues in Parliament.
Now we will be discussing COVID-19 updates in Quebec and Ontario as of September 23rd. Quebec reports 683 new cases, as well as 5 additional deaths. Pandemic-related hospitalizations rose by 6 to 280. To quote Global News, this includes 5 more patients in intensive care units compared with the previous day, for a total of 91, unquote. On Wednesday, health officials stated that 10,645 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine were administered in the province. 12.7 million doses have been administered since the beginning of the pandemic. According to Quebec's Public Health Institute, 89% of Quebec residents aged 12 and older have received at least one dose, with 84.5% fully vaccinated. Quebec's total number of cases, 104,974,000 in the latest update. 11,340 people have died in the province since the beginning of the pandemic. As of Wednesday, recoveries from the virus was at 387,000. In Ontario, 677 new COVID-19 cases were reported on Thursday, the 7-day average continuing to decline. Total cases in the province is now at 581,908,000. Of the new 677 cases, 433 people were unvaccinated, 41 were partially vaccinated, and 148 were fully vaccinated. 55 of the people have unknown vaccination status. According to the report on Thursday, in Toronto, there were 136 cases, 76 in Peel Region, 73 in York Region, 39 in Windsor-Essex, 39 in Durham Region, 38 in Hamilton, 31 in Middlesex-London, 29 in Ottawa, and 26 in Niagara Region. The number of deaths in Ontario has risen to 9,677. On Wednesday, 44,754 vaccines, 17,685 being a first shot, and 27,069 being a second shot, were administered. Over 10.3 million people in Ontario are fully vaccinated, being 79.6% of the population age 12 and up, while 85.5% of the population has a first dose. Recovery from COVID-19 in the province stands at 566,386, which is 97% of cases. There are currently 5,845 active cases in Ontario, down from the previous day. The current 7-day average in Ontario is 665, decreased from the previous day's average of 692. Royal Victoria Hospital, established in 1893, has a long history of service to the Milton Park and Golden Square Mile communities. The site has not been functioning as a hospital since 2015. However, according to an article by the McGill Daily, quote, recent development of new plans for the site concerns community members who fear for the future of the site and the communities it is meant to serve, unquote. The Daily outlines how the site was, quote, established with the intent that it must only be used for healing, unquote. Because of this, these new plans must seriously consider the needs of the community which it serves. The Milton Park Citizens Committee, a nonprofit organization, brought together groups from the Royal Vic for the Public Coalition, a coalition aimed at keeping Royal Victoria Hospital publicly owned. The coalition consulted members of the community on the privatization of the hospital. If the site is privatized, this could have serious implications for the needs of the community. There are many implications of the site, Royal Vic, being privatized. Majorly, this would further the gentrification of the area and, to quote the Daily, intensify the housing crisis. Unquote. During the pandemic, Royal Victoria Hospital was a shelter and quarantine location for houseless people who had COVID-19. The Daily outlined how if the site were to be privatized, this would, quote, further displace low-income residents and the communities, unhoused population, a population that is disproportionately Indigenous, unquote. The Milton Park Citizens Committee is urging the site to remain in service to the neighborhood through, quote, social housing, community spaces, education, and health resources, unquote. The open letter sent by the coalition has currently been signed by 62 organizations and states that, quote, the slopes of Mont Royal should not be reserved only for the elite, but should also be accessible to the general public, unquote. That was our weekly headline roundup. Now we've got some music followed by our audio essay.
Teen boy, I eat sticks and rocks and mud. I don't care about the government, and I really need a hug. I feel stupid, ugly, pretend it doesn't bother me. I'm not very strong, but I'll fuck you up if you're mean to bugs. Big boy now, and I'm very scary. I punch spider beetle bee. They don't say much, but they've always listened to me. The other boys at school think it's cool to hate your parents, but they're lying all the time. The bugs advise that I should let them. If you wanna cry, make sure that they never see it. Even better yet, block it out and never feel it. I just turned 14 and I think I know everything. Don't mess with me, I'm a big boy now and I'm very scary. I punch my wall, stay out at night and I do karate. Don't message me, cause I won't reply, I wanna make you cry.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. You're listening to CKUT on 90.3 FM. That was Walking Away Every Time by Oscar Lange, followed by Boys Will Be Bugs by Cave Town, followed by Adam by Alex G. Now we will be playing our audio essay. Today we're going to be talking about the history of voting for Indigenous people in Canada, as well as the lack of accessible voting and polling stations in past elections and this past election in Canada for Indigenous people. For those of you who are unaware, this September 30th is Truth and Reconciliation Day in Canada, so we thought it would be important to discuss the different ways in which the electoral system fails Indigenous people and does not uphold truth and reconciliation as a priority. We will be starting off by discussing a brief history of Indigenous people and voting in Canada. In 1876, the Indian Act was enacted in Canada. The law allowed Indigenous men to apply for enfranchisement in which they would have to terminate their own First Nations status in order to participate in voting. If the applicant was a doctor, lawyer, a notary public, minister, or priest, or had completed a university degree, their application would be automatically approved. However, if an applicant did not meet these credentials, they would be subjected to a review, and if they were approved, there was a 3-year period in which they were titled Probationary Indian. Enfranchisement was an extremely harmful and oppressive tactic for the Canadian government to dilute and erase Indigenous people in the country. From 1876 till 1920, a small number of 250 Indigenous people were approved for enfranchisement. Enfranchisement and its connection to voting intentionally made the process unattainable to maintain a colonizer's power imbalance and keep Indigenous peoples oppressed. In 1920, the Indian Act was amended from voluntary enfranchisement to involuntary enfranchisement of Indigenous men. The Canadian government would seek out Indigenous men who appeared, quote, deserving, unquote, of enfranchisement and would force them to apply. This was only in place for 2 years after opposition from First Nations communities. To quote an article from Elections Canada, "It is important to recognize that for women and children from First Nations communities, involuntary enfranchisement was an inherent feature of the enfranchisement provisions of the Indian Act until 1951. The reason for this is that when men applied for enfranchisement, their wife and children were automatically considered enfranchised, even if they were not specified in the application. Beginning in 1951, male applicants applying for enfranchisement were required to include reference to women and children in order for them to also be enfranchised. Although, of course, until 1985, Aboriginal women were losing their Indian status when they married someone who did not have Indian status." Unquote. It was only in 1960 when the government enacted the Canadian Election Act, which enabled all registered First Nations people the right to vote. However, it was not until 1962 when there were ballot boxes placed in all communities. So, for a full 2 years, voting was not actually accessible. The relationship between Indigenous people and voting in Canada is very complex for many reasons. But to highlight one reason in particular, since the 1960s, Indigenous people were given the right to vote. However, similar to other oppressed groups in the country, they were given the right to vote for their oppressor. Residential schools were still in operation for 36 years after Indigenous people were given the vote. I feel fortunate to be able to participate in a democratic system, but for many Indigenous people and other marginalized communities, for a long time there was no candidate who would truly protect and value them. Moving into past elections, I will now be discussing challenges faced by some Indigenous people in the 2015 election. Some First Nations communities are more remote. According to a CBC article, quote, "Getting to the polling station could mean walking, driving a vehicle, arranging a ride, or if available, using public transit," unquote. According to the AFN, some First Nations do not have a polling station in the community. In 2015, there were updates to the voter eligibility rules. The Assembly of First Nations said this made it more difficult to vote Indigenous people. To quote the CBC, "Under the new law, voters can use a driver's license or any other government-issued identification that has a photo and address. That excludes Indian status cards, which only have a photo," unquote. Despite the Liberal government's promises to First Nations communities, the election process itself is rooted in colonialist values, with disregard to the different possible situations of Indigenous people, making participating in the election an extremely difficult task for some. We're now going to be touching on the inaccessibility of polling stations in general in this past election. And then continuing into the inaccessibility of voting for Indigenous people.
In Saskatoon, a local resident said that his polling station was not set up for him to enter in his wheelchair, despite, quote, "the voter card said that this site meets all 15 accessibility criteria for Roland Missioner School," end quote. The door to the school gym where the station was located was raised about 7 centimeters high. After seeing this, it was clear that the man would not be able to enter the station and felt embarrassed as he had to leave past the lineup of people behind him. Marie-France Kenny, the Elections Canada regional manager advisor, told CTV that she couldn't comment on this specific station, but that the agency's officers, quote, "made every effort to choose polling locations that meet Election Canada's 15 mandatory accessibility criteria," end quote. She attempted to make the excuse that due to COVID and the need for larger venues to allow for physical distancing, some of the stations may not have met all of the accessibility criteria. But the man, who only recently started using a wheelchair, said that this is the same station he has gone to in the past years to vote. Not only this, but he also said that the Elections Canada staff told him that this concern was known to them. He told CTV, quote, "they said that they had identified it a week ago and no one did anything about it," unquote. The only way he was able to go to vote was to go in through the front of the school doors, where he had to pretend to be a parent in order to get into the school due to the school's COVID restrictions, and then proceed throughout the entire school in order to get to the gym. This story is one of many that draws attention to the lack of care and attention Elections Canada puts into encouraging those with accessibility issues to vote. Over the course of this past election, CTV News reports that nearly 5.8 million Canadians voted in advance polls, but 9 communities in Nunavut had to wait until Election Day to cast their ballots. What's more, residents of the communities that were out of town could not rely on casting a ballot by mail, as the long delivery times at Canada Post made it an unreliable option. Members of these communities were unable to receive the papers needed for the mail-in ballots, so it was a major issue when only 16 of Nunavut's 25 communities had access to advance polls. With the current COVID-19 pandemic, voting early is one of the only viable options for immunocompromised peoples, and in general, those who wanted to avoid crowds and lines. Access to polling stations across Canada is not a new issue, especially in Indigenous communities. A political science professor, Stuart Prest of Simon Fraser University, suggested to CTV that they could cast ballots via phone, which is something that happened in British Columbia during their recent provincial election. Diane Benson, a spokeswoman for Elections Canada, said, quote, "we recognize that there are Canada Post service delay standards up there that may make the deadlines tight," unquote, when discussing the concerns about mail-in ballots in Nunavut. Unfortunately, the mail-in ballots are not the only concerns. There is a lack of the Inuktitut language on the voting ballots, even though Statistics Canada says that it is the mother tongue of 65% of Nunavut residents. The Canada's Elections Act only requires the ballot to be in English and French.
Holding an election during a pandemic was unfair to Canadians in remote communities. With Canada entering the fourth wave of COVID-19, the election, not only was it risky, but also diminished the voices of those who did not have the luxury of voting in person. An Elections Canada survey found that in May 2021, 29.5% of voters insisted to vote by mail. With the continuing rise of COVID-19, based on last year's statistics, it is likely that the percentage of voters intending to use mail-in ballots would rise, especially for those living in remote communities. Small communities in the territories only receive mail 2 or 3 times a week. On top of pandemic postal delays, the result is that 36 days may not be long enough to request, receive, and send a mail-in ballot for many who live in remote areas of Canada. Knowing this, the Parliament could have passed a legislative amendment addressing these foreseeable mail-in ballot problems to avoid this issue, but this was not proposed. Further, by the Canada Elections Act, for those who requested a special ballot, you are unable to change your intention back to voting, even if there are mail delays. Further, if on reserve Indigenous voters can't easily get to the polls, they will have unequal access to voting. The location of polling stations, especially during a pandemic, has been known to have discriminatory impacts, and lack of easy access to polling stations has created barriers for racialized groups, specifically the Indigenous community. That was our audio essay. We hope you enjoy it. We're going to have a short music break, but stay tuned because we have some really important and helpful resources coming up.
No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. A misbehaving, saving my love for you, for you, for you, for you. I know for certain the one I love. I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of. A misbehaving, saving my love for you. Like Jack Horner in the corner, don't go nowhere, what do I care? Your kisses are worth waiting for. Leave me, I don't stay out late, no place to go. I'm home about eight, just me and my radio. Ain't misbehaving, saving all my love for you. Thank you.
trashed that apartment, stripped to the floorboards, flag on the chair like she's conquered the world. My bed stands taller than the one in her bedroom. We'll have none of that, we'll just lay on the floor. It's harder in theory, it's easy in person. We'll sort the logistics, there's room for the two of us in her narrow hallway. We dance in the corner, it's falling to me, but she's heard it before. For diamonds, who knows what you'll find. I'll remember your face, I'll lose track of the time. You search for something and it hits you blind. You ask to hang up your coat, can I stay a while? So close, I'll put creases in your clothes. Wake up at 8:45, drag your suitcase out the door. I knew you left in the morning, but now I'm Christopher walking down these streets you call home. Can I call you on the phone? 'Cause it gets dark in New York. No, it's the same on the West Coast. I'm holding it in, she's from the toughest of skin. When something comes, who knows what this turns into? But knowing everything's not fine. When you search for something and it hits you blind, you ask to hang up your coat, can I stay a while?
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. You're listening to CKUT on 90.3 FM. That was Ain't Misbehavin' by Fats Waller, followed by CGR by Sawyer Nunes. Now we've got our resource list. First up, we have an article by the McGill Daily. For more details on the Royal Victoria Hospital, check out the McGill Daily's article at mcgilldaily.com. Next, we have an article to check out by the CBC on suggestions for what to do on Truth and Reconciliation Day. The article outlines five main things, including, but not limited to, wearing orange, participating in an event, which they have attached to the article, supporting Indigenous arts and media, as well as educating yourself and learning Indigenous history in Canada. There is also an article by CTV News, which spoke to a survivor of residential schools, detailing how we can honor survivors of the residential school system. These articles can be found in each respective news outlet's online sites. In Unfit to Print's resource list, we have the Native Women's Shelter Montreal. We've talked about this shelter before on the show and encourage you to donate if you are able. That's all for today. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. We'll be leaning out with a couple songs. First, we have Love Song for the Haters by Fleece, followed by Radio Cure by Wilco, and Cute by Alex G.
I put it's your picture on the wall. So I could see you so small.
Cheer up, honey, I'll filled with silvery stars. Honey kisses clouds of flowers. Shoulders shrugging off. Cheer up.
McGill University's 4th annual Queer History Month is taking place this October. The featured keynote presentation is taking place from 6 to 7:30 p.m. on Friday, October 1st, with entomologist Jessica Ware of Rutgers University. Join in later in the month for more exciting programming, including a chat with an elder session from 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday, October 19th, a zine-making workshop on Thursday, October 21st from noon to 2 p.m., a trans and non-binary in academia panel discussion on Wednesday, October 27th from 6 to 8 p.m., and finally, a queer open mic night with performances by Opera Queens on Thursday, October 28th, also from 6 to 8 p.m. Visit the Equity at McGill webpages, www.mcgill.ca/equity, for a complete list of Queer History Month events organized by McGill's Office of the Provost and Vice Principal Academic and their partners. Queer History Month will be opened and closed by Elder Gawenodas Sedalio Fazio. The goal of McGill's Queer History Month is to raise awareness, advance education, and increase visibility of 2S LGBTQIA communities by recognizing their histories and contributions, building bridges, and bringing together McGill students, staff, faculty, and alumni, and Montreal community members.
P90.3 FM is proud to rebroadcast the following program entirely in the Mohawk language. The Mohawk, or Ganyatgahaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Chojaake. The Ganyatgahaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR Reviving Ganasadage Radio. And now, listen to Chojaake's indigenous language on CKUT.
Se agu se wa gwe gwne se wa damste gi gwne oska te wanyo wa dan oska hiu di stokwere zaad FM ne gi wa higi gwne wa hni diyo. Dan o gi gwne da has wa teta. Dan o o ya jate nyo dan ki nu ma muni ser daate. Ne ne gwa ki gagar diyos ne a ye jo het ste sok a ya.